Well, somehow or other, you would never get otherwise. You know something of the history of the Indians in America, and you're going to learn more. Incidentally, Chief Thundercloud said that King Philip had a wonderful speech.
Oh,
we should collect in our textbook. But I thought that that the most interesting thing to do would be for us to pursue this whole question of the Indian culture today. For instance, this chief who just died, and this man who is sworn not to reveal any of his in any of his folklore or any of his material to anybody. But before we go into that, I'd like to ask Chief Thundercloud to tell a story that he's told before about when he was a boy and went to school, and the teacher called Indian savages.
All right. Yeah.
I think I was in the sixth grade at the time, and we had we were studying history, and the pupils would read from the book, and then the book would be passed to the person behind, and they would read a paragraph. And so when it came to my turn to read, it said something like, "The savage Indians came out of the forest and burned the homes of the pioneers." So I told the teacher, "Well, I'm not going to read that." So she said, "Well, why not?" I said, "Because of that savage part." So she said, "Well, that's part of the lesson I have to read." I said, "No, that's calling my own people savages, and I'm not going to do that." And there was another Indian boy in the class also. And he said, "Well, I'm not going to do it either. I'm not going to read that." So she said, "Well, you're going to go to the principal's office." Remember the principal here? His name was Dr. Carr. He was a pretty stern-looking man. So they went to the office there, and teacher told him why we weren't there, why we were there. He said, "Well, that's a lesson, and you have to read what's in the book." So I said, "No, I refuse to read that." He said, "You know, let somebody else read that, and then let me read something else." He said, "No." So as a punishment, he gave me, never forget, it was a card with these problems, arithmetic problems on it. I took these problems home in addition to my other homework. And my father kept wondering why my homework was taking me so long. So he said, "What are you doing?" So he saw the card. He said, "Well, what are you doing these problems for?" So then I told him. He said, "And he gave you this because you didn't want to read the word savage?" I said, "Yes." He said, "All right, we'll go up to the school in the morning." So in the morning, I came up to school with my father, came to the room, and I had a big smile on my face. My father told me, he says, "You know, wipe the smile off your face, don't show off." So I came in and he said, "Listen, this is my son, and you know he's an Indian." She said, "Yes." "And you insisted on him reading this?" So she said, "Yes." He said, "Well, I don't want to ever hear anything like this again." He said, "I'm going down to the principal's office now." So he went down to the principal's office, and yeah, I thought the principal would do a double take when we walked in there. And my father said, "You gave him this homework because he refused to read the word savage." He said, "Yes, that's part of the lesson." He said, "Well, it's not part of the lesson for him." He said, "And if you ever do that again, I have to come back up here." He said, "You want to see what a real savage is like." So that was my experience. And of course, after that, when we had this book, I'm not sure, I think it was called the Guinness American History.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, the Indian was certainly not a hero, and he was the villain. And all throughout the book, it spoke in dismay. But I was never called upon again to read anything like that. It would always be somebody else who had to do it. And then a few instances, the teacher just happened to leave the word out.
Now, would you tell us about this chief who died? Tell us something about him.
Well, Chief Wild Horse, his civilian name was Clinton Marcellus Haynes. And he was 72 years old. He was a Wampanoag Indian. It's spelled W-A-M-P-A-N-O-A-G. Most people pronounce it Wampanoag. And this is a tribe that originally met the Pilgrims. And they lived originally in what is part of central Massachusetts and Cape Cod and all the outlying islands. Today they still live in the town of Mashpee and in the town of Cedarville on the Cape and the island of Martha's Vineyard in a village called Gayhead. Now Wild Horse grew up. He grew up when there were a lot of older Indians around who knew an awful lot of the language and of the ceremonies and of the culture and songs and rituals and hunting formulas. Different. A hunting formula is something that you say before you go hunting, or you see the animal and you say something, and this is supposed to make it easier for you to shoot the animal. And he knew trapping, how to make traps. But because people in the village ridiculed him, they made fun of him, well, it made him very bitter against the people in his own tribe. For one reason, once in a while he would wear long hair, wear his hair in braids, and you don't see this in Massachusetts. There are a lot of Indians there, nobody wears braided hair. But so they would make fun of him because he would cling to these type of beliefs. And they should have realized that when they were doing this, they were really only hurting themselves, because he became so bitter towards his own people that he wouldn't even teach his children the language. See, that was rather sad too, because he remarried. And his children they almost came to hate being Indian because he went to school in Middleborough, Massachusetts. And the children used to call them fast horse and slow horse and crazy horse. And they got so they used to just hate, you know, just the idea. So when he traveled and met other Indians who believed the same as he did, why, he was a different type of person. And that's how I came to meet him. He also once was a member of the police force in Mashpee. He was a wonderful athlete. I think he broke the record in Massachusetts once for a 10 mile race and for a 100-yard dash. He was a musician. He could play the piano, the trumpet, the saxophone, violin, the cello, and he was a beautiful artist. And some of his paintings now, they were on exhibit in the New Bedford Public Library. And they're all paintings with an Indian theme, but really, really fine work. And now they want to get these back right away. He was a sensitive man, but he would sit down and talk to anyone who was interested. So he was into, if some of his own people in his own tribe had come to him and just asked him a question and done it in sincerity, well, he would have been glad to talk. But sometimes Indians are not too forgiving, and sometimes they hold long grudges. And of course, this is what happened.
Wasn't that unusual for him to take up painting?
No, because most Indians are pretty good at painting.
How did it happen? Do you know? Did somebody teach him, or did he just?
I think he was just a natural artist. And some of the paintings are, well, they're really large. I mean, it's one that's almost, well, it's almost the size of the blackboard, and done in oils, but really, really good-looking work. And he was a poet. He wrote, he had a poem. It was called The Poetry of Massasoit that he did, and this is the last thing that I heard him do publicly, July the 11th, at the powwow. He was a very qualified man. One thing I am glad that I did, I talked to him in 1959, and I told him that Dartmouth College would like to record the Wampanoag language. And so he said to me, no white man is going to get this language. No. So I talked to him, and I talked with him, and I told him, look, you won't teach it to your own people, and I understand the reasons, but it's really a shame for this to die. So Dr. Day from Dartmouth is a man who understands Indians. He's a fine man. He's sincere. And if you will get together with him, I'm sure you will find it will be a wonderful thing for posterity. So finally, he did agree to meet Dr. Day. He didn't make any promises, but we met in New Bedford in 1959. We met in a restaurant, and I sort of tricked him, I guess, to get him to talk a little Indian. I would say how we say a certain thing in the Tota language, and then Dr. Day would say, see, Dr. Day speaks to the language of the Abenaki Indians who live in Canada. This is a group that Rogers Rangers destroyed that village in the French and Indian War. Dr. Day would say, well, the Abenaki say it this way, and then Wild Horse would say, well, no, we say it a little differently. So he, Dr. Day, he said, do you mind if I write that down? So he said, no, it's all right. So he wrote it down. And then finally, he, after a number of meetings, he agreed to record the language. And then a week before he was to go to Dartmouth to do this, he had a terrible accident and his car was demolished. He wasn't hurt too badly, but this sort of put it off, the recording. But finally, he did go up there and did record the Wampanoag language for Dartmouth. But so that if people are interested today, Dr. Day felt that he didn't give him all that he knew. He felt that he held some things back, which is possible. But at least there are some things in Wampanoag that younger people from the tribe, if they do get interested. And they are little by little now, they are changing. They have seen kids their own ages come into the powwow and perform. For instance, her two boys, they've seen them perform. Now, up there now, there are at least 15 children from 9 to 13 who will now put on a costume and are learning to dance. Now the hope is now to get the teenagers involved to see if they will. They'll do the other things in a minute, the jerk and the mouse, these other things, but now we feel that since these contests have been started with the trophies, we feel now that the younger people will wear costume and not feel self-conscious about it, and maybe this will be the means of reviving Indian dances and ceremonies in the East.
Now I can understand why this chief's children didn't want you to have the Indian ceremony. I mean, what you told me about there being teased at school and so on.
Yes, I was in the hospital Sunday talking with him, and only the family was admitted, but his sister told him that I was a relative, and that way I got in to see him. And when the two daughters came in, they asked what I was doing there. So she said, well, you know, it's your father's wishes that he was here. See, this is the second time. He had one stroke in 4 years ago, and I left New York at night, and I got up there in the morning, and I went to see him at the hospital. And of course, he could talk. And when he had this stroke, he was in pretty good. The first stroke, he was in pretty good condition, because I remember the chief of police came in to see him, and he said, "Well, chief," he said, "how do you feel?" So he said, "Well, I don't feel like running any 100-yard dashes." But he said, otherwise, I'm not too bad. But you see, this time, he couldn't answer me. I could just tell by the movement of his head and the way his eyes moved that he could understand. The nurse said he could hear. So I talked to him in his own language, which I had learned some of, and told him that I was there and I would stay there. But the daughters afterwards, they had a family, sort of a family quarrel right there, you know, almost within hearing distance. So I asked them if they'd all went out to the reception.
You mean they differed as to whether to have this?
Yes, and that was very bad for him to hear this.
Yeah.
So I asked them if they'd gone out to the reception room. And so they went down there. And then after they finished talking, then I went back and I talked to them. And I told them, you know, why this should be and so forth. So they did come up to me after the funeral, and they apologized, and they said that they are very happy that I was there to do it for the father, because he knew that there was no one else.
That was good.
So they, and then the aunt said, "Now, isn't it sad that you girls never took enough interest to learn all the things that your father knew?" And they said, "Yes, it is." So the son was faithful. The son came to see him all the time.
And he argued with them.
The son didn't say anything there, but I understand that when they got home that night, that he really talked to them, because the son goes to powwows, and he can't dance because he lost the use of this arm through an automobile accident. And the son's name is Squanto. He was named after the Squanto in history, the one of the pilgrims. Really, Tisquantum. Mm-hmm. He's named for his father. His name is Tisquantum Wild Horse Ames.
Now, there was another. What about this other man who I intend is still living? This lady. Would you tell us about her?
Well, William James, was a Wampanoag Indian, also a member of the same tribe. And he lived in a very plain house, a little three room house, unpainted. And he was a man that really should have been born, I guess, 100 years ago, because he believed in all the old Indian traditions. And he also used to be made fun of by other people in the tribe. But he sort of had his own way of making fun of other people also, in retaliation. For example, one day he said to me, he said, they all make fun of me because I live in this little house. He said, well, these people have a beautiful house over there. He said, but there's a mortgage on it. And he said, they have beautiful furniture. And if they don't pay for it, a furniture company will take it away. He said, my furniture, most of it I made, and it's my own. He said, I don't have a modern bathroom. But he said, I have a little outhouse out there, and that's all mine. I don't have a big car. But he said, I had this little Chevrolet, and this is mine, and I don't have to worry about losing it. But he was also knew how to prepare a lot of Indian foods. Up there, they had herring. All of you know what herring are. And they have these herring runs in Mashpee. They're built today with cement, where the herring spawn. They come in the spring, and they come down, they drop down this little trough, and gee, on a Sunday afternoon, you see people there with scoop nets, just scooping the herring up. He used to cook them in a brown paper bag. I don't know how he did it. Put them in the oven. They used to be delicious. But he knew the language, and he would talk to me in his language, but he wouldn't talk to other people. So because they made fun of him, he said, when I know that I am dying, all of my papers and manuscripts and legends and everything, he said, we've built a special incinerator. My sister is going to put that incinerator near my bed, and I'm going to set fire to all these things. One thing happened while I was up there that really made him very, very bitter. It was during the winter, and he went out on Mashpee Pond, and he went over to cut a block of ice from his refrigerator. And there was a white man who owned a house on the shore, and he told him he didn't want anybody cutting ice. I mean, a piece of ice this big. So he said, you see that? He said, I can't even cut a block of ice. So he said, and I won't give the language. He said, if I give the language to any of the boys here, he said, a white man will come along and order whiskey, and they'll tell him everything that they know. So what happened, when he was dying, he carried out his promise. And they sent for me also to come up. But at the time, I myself was ill in the hospital. And if I could have gotten out, I didn't have enough time. I really regretted that I couldn't carry out his service, because the people in the tribe, they sort of neglected him.
Did he speak freely to you?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Did you have trouble getting to the point where you could speak freely to him? Or
No, he just made me promise he would write anything down.
He did.
Yes, he said to me, now when you leave and go back, I was staying with the son of the lady whose picture I told you knew all the herbs.
Mm-hmm.
He said, now when you go back to Miss Bessie's, he said, just don't write anything down. He said, will you promise me that? I said, yeah, I promise. So I never wrote anything down. But I remembered some words. I remembered different things, but I didn't teach them to anyone.
Did he burn all of it? Did he carry it?
Well, you know, his sister got the things mixed up. She saved the language, but burnt the legends and the manuscripts and the other things and the herbal uses. But she has the language. But she's a very odd person. She's very difficult to reach. She's even more difficult to reach now since his death. I mean, we were all good friends, but I went there with Dr. Day, and I just said, because I knew she remembered the language, because you can't lose it. You can't lose a language in 10 years. So I introduced her to Dr. Day, and I said, this is Dr. Day from Dartmouth. And I told him that you were one of the speakers at Wampanoag. And she said, oh, I only remember three words, big white teeth, and that's all. And she just dismissed it like that. She was, you know, courteous, but she wouldn't go into anything. And her daughter, it's sort of sad, when she got married, she just didn't like married life. And she has a daughter, and the daughter's not been able to get anything from her either. And the daughter really wants to learn in the worst way. And the daughter has nine children, all of whom would like to learn. But it's probably easier for me to talk to her than it is for her own daughter. Because these people have suffered so much ridicule. They used to say they were... See, they knew legends. They knew all these old things that the people claim were witchcraft. So people used to sort of be away from them. Now, there was an old lady named Mercy Hendricks. When I first went to Mashpee, I went to visit this lady. And I had dinner there and talked with her. I used to hear beautiful stories, and I came out of there one day, and a friend of mine said, he said, aren't you afraid to go there? I said, afraid of what? I said, she's a witch. I said, no. He said, did you eat in there? I said, yes. He said, well, I feel sorry for you. Well, I went there many a time. I never had any problem. She was a sweet old lady and was just willing to just to talk to someone, but here was this attitude. This is not too long ago. This is 1948.
Was she terribly isolated?
No, just lived.
She had friends
right up on the hill near the school. But the children would go by and they'd wave to her, but they would never take cookies or anything from her. You know, she tried to be friendly. She had a very serious face.
They had been instructed by their parents.
She had a very serious face, and she had white hair, which she couldn't always keep toned. And they used to say when she hung out clothes, and, you know, her hair was flying, you know, they used to say things about it. But she was really a fine lady.
This lady who has the manuscript, is she as bitter as her brother was?
Yes. Yes, she is. She is.
Well, do you think there were any special incidents that happened to them that made them more bitter?
Well, I think... Perhaps the ridicule that they might have gone through years ago when Mashpee was a poor town, and people in the surrounding towns used to make fun of them. They used to work in the cranberry box, numerous cranberry boxes in Mashpee, some of which belonged to Ocean Spray, or they leased from the people, and they weren't always well off. Today, Mashpee is a fairly prosperous town. It covers 20 square miles. It has a population of about 600, whom I would say it has more than 600 now, with the new development down there. But I would say there are about 350 Indians. The school has six rooms, cafeteria, and now they're adding on a museum.
Now, this place was once an Indian reservation.
It was
right?
A reservation until 1870, and then they wanted to become a town, just like other towns. So they had their own offices. They had selectmen, which in some communities are called aldermen or committeemen. And the selectmen run the affairs of the town. They had the shellfish warden, the game warden, the fence viewer, bookkeepers, and so forth. And most of these offices are held by Indians, and I think four of them are held by women, the treasurer of the town. The chief of the tribe today is a Earl H. Mills, Chief Flying Eagle, who is a physical education instructor at Lawrence High School in Falmouth. And he doesn't know much about Indian history or background, but he's interested, but he didn't have too good a relationship with Wild Horse either. And but he's a fine young man who's done a lot for the tribe. He's helped to rebuild the Indian church. You see, you have an Indian church here that was built, no, I think that church was built in 1677. It's made of wood. And it's off the main highway. There's a sign here, it's called the Indian Church. It's open for services in the summertime. And Harvard College helps to support this. But the church was falling down in 1949. The church was in very, very bad condition, so it wasn't really safe to go in there. And in the summertime, black snakes used to get up on top of the rafters. And sometimes a person would be sitting there and the snake would just drop down because he's coming through the windows. But I went up there in 57 and told the people that I thought it was a shame that they had stopped their annual powwow. For 10 years, they just let the powwow just die right out. So I had a meeting with the people there in 1957 and revived the powwow, and now it's held annually. And the money from this powwow goes to keep up the Indian church. The people don't use the church in the wintertime. They have another church, a new church in the town, that they use in the winter, and then in the summer they go up there. And then, of course, the burying ground is up there. And the people are, most of the older people all buried in Indian costume. And on their, some of them weren't always able to have gravestones, and they have some of them with these, they made wooden markers, chief red jacket. Most of them will have their Indian names instead of the civilian names on the markers. But now, most of the graves now have stones. And on the stones, they have the Indian name and the person's civilian name. Some very, very old graves, a number of Civil War veterans.
Have you tried to figure out any way, or are you going to try to get that manuscript?
Yes, I'm going to talk with her. I'm going to try my best. I don't know how I'll make out, because if she's made this pledge, it's going to be very, very difficult. But we may be able to work something out. Because she has a number of grandchildren who just rarely get a chance to see her, because she stays in the house, she goes to the post office, she's very withdrawn. She will attend things like the powwow, but she doesn't mix very well. She just doesn't mix. She has a very, very fine face, very piercing eyes.
Now, we have a few minutes, and I've been monopolizing the questions. Would you like to ask some questions? Yes?
Well, when it comes to age, is there any custom that you have?
But you know, when you speak about Indians, it's very hard to generalize. In different tribes, there are different customs. Today, it would depend upon how closely your tribe followed its customs. Now, the Apaches, Seminoles, Navajos, some of those people still follow these customs, these rites when a child becomes of age, a girl becomes of age, a boy becomes of age. This wouldn't be true of Indians in upper New York State.
Well, when you wear a certain number of feathers on your back, does it mean something?
In some tribes, these two feathers are, I'm ashamed to tell you, are not even eagle feathers. And these are turkey feathers that are dyed to look like eagle feathers. But I just don't want to take two out of here to wear them in my hair. These are worth about $12 each. Because it's against the law not to hunt eagles. But recently, I think it was just last month, the United States government gave the privilege to some Indian groups to hunt eagles again. Hunt eagles? Well, they don't kill them, but they trap them, and then they pluck the feathers. And what they do, you make a trap, you make a, what do you call it, a pit trap. You get down in the pit, and you bait it, and you cover it with branches and leaves. And then when the eagle comes down to get the bait, you reach up over there, and you grab him by his hind feet, and then somebody else plucks the feathers. And then, of course, they grow back, but they don't kill them. Now, the Zunis in New Mexico raise eagles. They've been raising them for years. But there's one man among the Seneca Indians in New York State who is one of the few men left who is an eagle hunter, who knows how to hunt eagles. And he was working with Dr. William Fenton from the New York State Museum. And Dr. Fenton said something in one of his manuscripts about one of his books about this man that he didn't like. And when Dr. Fenton went up there to work with him on the Seneca Eagle Dance and how it's done and why it's done, he spent 2 months working with this man. So Dr. Fenton was trying to find someone who knew where there was an eagle hunter. And they told him that there was a Seneca up on the Six Nations Reservation in Brampton, Ontario, who was an eagle hunter. So Dr. Fenton, he went all the way up to Ontario to see this eagle hunter. So when he got to Ontario, he told him, so gee, the best eagle hunter among all the Iroquois is John Jimerson. So he said, which John Jimerson? He said, John Jimerson down at Allegheny Reservation. He said, well, I've been working with John Jimerson for 2 months. So he said, well, he's the expert. So then when he went back to John Jimerson, he said, John, he said, why didn't you tell me that you were an eagle hunter? And he said, well, you know, he said, you wrote something once on your books. I didn't like it. And he said, well, listen, I want to do some work on eagle hunters. So he said, well, let's discuss the performance fees first. But this is another instance where somebody does something to rub someone the wrong way. Sometimes writers in Mashpee would write, Cape Cod writers would write unfavorable remarks concerning the people. Then somebody reads these and they just close up. They won't have anything to do with a writer. They're very leery of writers.
I think that Thundercloud gave me an example of how people can be insensitive about things. After this funeral ceremony, one of the reporters wanted him to repeat the ceremony so he could take a picture of it.
Is that something? I told him no. I said, I wouldn't do that. I said, and it's lucky for you that the other men over there, the pallbearers, didn't hear you. But I said, if you want, when we go to the cemetery, we're going to have another ceremony there. It would be all right, but I would just stand there and pose and say something. It's, you know, this is terrible.
Yes?
What kind of work do women have?
Beg pardon?
What kind of work do women have?
In the old days or today?
Both.
Well, in the old days, the woman's job was to build a house. She also owned it. So that if there's ever an argument with the husband, she didn't have to say much because she could just tell him to just take his things and leave. And he would have to stay out until she gave him permission to come back in. And then they planted. The women did the planting. And they did the sewing and the cooking. Today, since we're speaking about the Montagnards and Mashpee, today the women up there, some of them school teachers, from the village of Gayhead, which is on Martha's Vineyard, a number of the Indian girls there have gone on to teach, and teaching Indians out west, and won scholarships. The Catawba, C-A-T-A-W-B-A, from South Carolina.
Is this in the Great Valley? That valley of the Appalachian Mountains? There's a big valley? Yes.
Well, the Catawba country is near Charlotte.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it's sort of the Piedmont region, I guess.
The Catawba is inland. Gee, we're 122 miles from saltwater.
Uh-huh. You're in sort of the tobacco country, is Charlotte?
Cotton, a lot of cotton.
Yeah,
a lot of cotton.
I think that's the Piedmont region.
And tobacco. And not the Catawbas, but there's another tribe living not too far from the Catawbas. You see the men in town, they have overalls on. They have so many patches on the overalls, you don't know which was the original cloth, but these men are all prosperous farmers and have big cars and raise their families, and the children all go to college. So I just, you know, just put values, certain values on certain things.
Now, yes.
The men had the job of hunting and fishing and protecting the family. And sometimes in the movies and TV, they show this always wrong. It looks, you see the men smoking and relaxing, and the women carrying all these heavy things on their backs. But they never stopped explaining that hunting, in those days, that was a full-time job. A man went out and just had to bring back something to eat. And but they didn't say like today, say, well, today in time we'll have a field. I mean, they didn't know what they would have. They would have something, but they would just bring back whatever they had. And sometimes they had community. They had a big community pot in the wintertime, and a man would come in and maybe throw a duck in there, maybe another one throw an alligator tail or a beaver tail, but they had plenty of vitamins. And yes? Yes, in some tribes, yes, in some tribes.
In the tribes in the West, do they still go to the ceremonies and
appoint
the warriors? Like,
I think only if the family believes in it or if they want it. Sometimes it's a little difficult sometimes, because sometimes the churches don't like them to do those things. It all depends on where the Indians are. Now, if they're indifferent and have their own religion, then they just go on their own way. Now, in Little Songbird's tribe, the Caribbeans, these are the people who came from Venezuela and then migrated to all of the islands in the Caribbean Sea. They were a seagoing people. When you think of Indians, most people think of the canoe with two people paddling, or the dugout canoe, which the Long Island Indians and the Indians in Massachusetts use, with 15 men in it. But the Caribs made boats that held sometimes 200 men. And they came from the islands in the West Indies and fought against Indians living in what is now Florida. They were great, they were sailors among the American Indians.
Well, I'm afraid we'll have to stop now. Thank you very much.
All right, gentlemen.
Kind of person. We have parents who are sometimes reluctant to get the help they need, and sometimes they delay beyond what should happen. But by and large, these situations, what is being done is under the most expert guidance. But I'd like to go back to the point I made originally. We lost a year with these youngsters in this structure. Because the structure we had last year made it possible for them, with all of the teachers involved, for them not to have the kind of very close regime which they needed.
Now,
and
could I interrupt here? Because I think this is a most important point. I have told every one of these parents that they can call me at any time, because these youngsters go home and tell their parents that there's no homework. And the parents then say, what is this school? The children don't do anything. This is what their complaint was last year. And the child comes, even though I gave a mimeograph sheet last year, the homework for the week, still they wouldn't take it home, and the parents would...
You mean these three children?
Yeah.
Yes.
See,
this
so
is
they,
difficult.
This
is difficult.
The fact that there was plenty
you
of
see,
homework.
You see, there was a whole year in which they were taught that it is possible to move along without doing work.
And even this
because
year,
of the fact that they, that with this structure, there wasn't the close follow-up, the immediate follow-up that is necessary. So that I think we have to, in assessing the situation, I think we have to see that, because just as soon as this started, this is just the end, we've just passed the end of October, and long before the end of October, Freddie was bringing in homework. John was doing work, Phyllis was working. Now this came simply because of this structure which made them live up to their obligations. Not in itself, but part of the whole picture of an intellectual life where there were satisfactions to be gotten from achievement. So that, and you can't take one of these things and isolate it. But I think the lack of this particular thing caused this situation to become as to have the seriousness that it has now. And I think that now we have to see what is happening here. I don't think for one minute that these youngsters should feel the situation is such that they can go into French and disrupt.
No.
You see, this must not happen.
I know.
And we must devise some way. I don't know. I think it requires more thought than we can give to it right now. But I think we must devise some way so that the situation isn't such that they learn that this is possible. Because where the structure holds them up, they respond. But where it is possible, you see, this happens. Now, I think we ought to get a picture of what's happening in some of the other areas.
Norman,
yes?
May I ask about the experiment of last year? What is this lack of?
Oh, this was the situation. We're a small junior high school, 7th and 8th grades. And we set this up in a way that it makes me sort of tired to think about it at this point. Una had social studies and English for both groups, which involves a tremendous amount of homework, a tremendous amount of their whole school life, because this is the way it seemed, you know, best at that point to organize it. Dave Glazier, whose strength is in the fields of mathematics and science, had mathematics and science. Dave was homeroom teacher for the 7th grade, and they were in the 7th grade. And the whole process of two busy teachers trying to coordinate this thing, if they didn't bring in homework for Una, of coordinating this, of responding quickly and so on, was a kind of situation where they could fall between two stools. And they did. And this is the kind of thing that we eliminated by the kind of structure we have now. Now, let's hear about what they're doing in some of these other areas.
Johnny came to the school in the 5th grade, which was my year away at Puerto Rico, so that I did not meet him the first year, but I was told when I returned that he was a boy who might possibly give me trouble by the art teacher who took over for the 1 year. There were three Johns in that class, so I really had to discount this at the beginning, but I soon could see what she meant. He would throw things as soon as my back was turned. He was not in the least bit interested in art. Coming out of the classroom meant a free-for-all for Johnny. And for a while, it was touch and go. I'd send him down to Norman. I'd send him back to Sam, who was his teacher then. There were times when he just couldn't come to some of these subject areas because he was so disruptive. But finally, in getting him to feel that he could work in art, he's an extremely talented boy, extremely talented. When he had his first real success, he was really won over. This doesn't mean that I didn't have moments of trouble with him. But, you know, he pulled someone's hair, he put chalk under my foot when he knew I was going to step there so that I almost, you know, broke my neck once. And it's hard to hold back when, as you're falling. It's like slipping on a banana. I'll never forget that experience. But somehow, by trying to work it out with him and overlooking certain things he did, which I would not let another child get away with, he realized that I wasn't going to pay attention to him only for the negative things. And gradually, he did a complete drawing and he did a complete painting. And what he did was beautiful, and everyone looked at it and realized what he could do. And this, I believe, is what helped to bring him over to our side in the art room. He is a capable, talented child.
How does he function this year?
I haven't had him in art. He's in a shop group. But he comes in to visit every time, you know, on his way there and his way back if he's late or something. And he'll say hello, and he's very friendly and very warm. He used to make terrible statements about everybody else's work. He can't get away with that now because no one picks him up on it. Even if he tries to say it, we continue with what we were doing as though nothing was said. And then he'll say, oh, I really like it, you know, or he'll make a more positive statement. So I can see a great deal of growth in Johnny. I don't think I had to send him out much last year. He really worked beautifully in the art room. His greatest strength is in drawing, and he feels it now, and he knows it, and so he'll choose that quite often because it does give him a very nice feeling. With Phyllis and Freddie, the light dawned at about the same time. Neither one of them seems to become involved in their artwork with any debt. They could not, at the beginning, spend more than one period on something. And Freddie, in fact, would do five or six things in one period, much more on the first or second grade level. His drawing ability is on that level, and so is Phyllis's to this day. They're much better designers, and they feel more strength in the design area. But their level of perception, as far as being able to put down on paper what they look at...
Excuse me, I think that there's an interesting pattern there, that they function best in the classroom, which is structured, and they cannot take much freedom, and they function best in art, in a design which is structured, and not in a free creative kind of...
Well, no, it is a free creative kind of design, but it's not specific. It's not as specific or structured still as a regular classroom.
But the mere fact that it is a design means that it has more structure than a more creative kind of art.
Well, I think we can have a long discussion on that, which I don't know that there's enough take for it.
Unless you deny the definition of design.
No, but design is creative.
But within the structure.
Yes. In other words, they didn't just...
All right, I wouldn't mind.
Yeah. They didn't just fling paint at the wall.
Yeah.
There was some structure to what they were doing, but they were not called upon to duplicate something they had looked at. They still cannot sketch a figure on anything but a second or third grade level.
Are they ashamed of their art?
No, they're not. And I'll tell you why. Because they have had such success in certain areas of the art room that they don't care. And nobody, that's what's wonderful about the group. You see, no one will come over and say, you know, how could you do that? Whereas my NYU student teacher, who is no longer with us, in front of the group picked up a drawing Phyllis had done and said, this was done by an eighth grader, at which point I would have liked to have fallen into a hole. But our eighth graders don't say that, because each child is different. Each child grows and develops at his own rate of speed. It's not that they're old ladies and gentlemen. It's not that they can't be nasty to each other in their own way. But they have a respect, which I really think is wonderful. Phyllis and Freddie did beautifully, again in design, when we worked with linoleum prints in the sixth grade. And that was the answer for them. They did printing, and they did overprinting and off-printing. And they got some really wonderful prints. And this was like the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. So that from that point on, although they have tried to grow and improve in the drawing area, and they are blocked, I don't know what Annie has on their drawing in her test. I'd be interested in knowing that. But they are limited in perspective and in their ability to see in depth or to draw what they're looking at specifically. Not as a commercial artist, but even to get a feeling of depth and rounding.
See, they can't paint word pictures either. They can't use words to describe.
There is really a lack of...
These tools can't have their same projection to material.
Well, they could project in the design area. I can't think of I think they have the possibility, but they haven't unblocked enough. I haven't possibly helped them to unblock enough to get to feel the freedom they need to expand in the specifics of drawing the figure and some perspective, etc. They are no trouble at all in the art room. Freddie and Phyllis were the worst whiners I had ever met. and they no longer speak in a whining manner. They no longer nag me with a question, they ask the question. But they don't think for themselves yet as much as I hope they will eventually, much more than they did to begin with. They would ask questions about things where the answer was right in front of them, and yet they wanted the attention, the personal attention of your response or of my response.
You see, I think there is an important point in terms of hindsight. If we had, at that point where we took in over half a class in 2 years, if we had been screening and had been able to realize that we were getting three youngsters whose problems were acted out in such a public way, that this was unfortunate, and this certainly one would want to avoid. Because here, as was indicated, these kids reacted on each other. But I think Sam will bear me out on this. I don't know, maybe he wasn't able to observe as much last year, but I think that Johnny, the year he was with you, where all of these subjects were done with a teacher, with one teacher who was closely on top of him, that he did much better. And his behavior, his general control was much better the year before in the sixth grade than it was last year in the seventh grade.
I don't have any, just as you say, I have no way of judging that because I wasn't close to the situation last year except casual observation. But I will verify that he certainly did better at the end of the sixth year than he did at the beginning of the sixth year. What that was due to, I don't know, but one could speak to him with more understanding on his part. There was less sullenness, there was more agreement that he could be wrong and that he had to do certain things. In other words, he was maturing. Now, what these elements in maturation are is always a difficult thing for me to perceive. One can get a feeling of satisfaction in seeing the end result, seeing the growth. But as I say, it's always difficult to pinpoint how these things happen.
But I can verify Norman's comment that the change that took place this summer was a dramatic one.
Yes.
It was a different boy who came into this school than the one who left last June.
And yes, we've had a rough time, I can assure you of that, and the end is not yet in sight, because there's still a lot has to be done.
I noticed it at camp. I came up to camp toward the end of the summer, and I really didn't recognize him, because there was a smiling John, and very friendly to me, whereas in school he would never look at me, and it seemed to me he was always scowling, and he was this open face, smiling.
Well, here was a boy who was sure that he could function well in any camp situation. There was
He came to that program on Sunday, and he wasn't supposed to come, but feels so part of camp, even on the trip. Going back to camp was such an experience for him. He just loved it.
I'd like to indicate another area that might bear discussion. I think in speaking about Johnny, he's a problem that is different than speaking about Phyllis and Freddie. Now, without emphasizing too much the importance of an intelligence base, it seems to me that there's some validity in recognizing that Johnny, I'm sure, although I haven't seen any results, would test very high on an intelligence test. Johnny is the potential is very great with Johnny. The emotional difficulties, emotional blocks have been the things to overcome. Once you overcome those things, I think you'll see a tremendous fruition of ability, because he has it, whether it's in art, or whether it's in speaking, or whether it's in physical activity, or whatever it be, he has the potential. Whereas I have a feeling with Phyllis and Freddie that the potential there is not so great. That even though there be emotional problems, unfortunately, the I mean, and I'm not speaking from any tests, just from observation. It seems to me that, unfortunately, there is a consistency between a poor emotional development and a poor intellectual development on their part. That is based in large measure to pick a UN handouts when they handed out intelligence to these kids.
This is something I think we really need, everybody is really struggling to find out, which came first, the chicken or the egg.
I think that we don't pay enough attention. I agree that some sources whose philosophies we don't want to embrace pay too much attention to this intelligence business, but I don't think we ought to throw that out the window. And I have a feeling in discussing these things that we don't realize sufficiently in our discussion. I think we realize it in our work with these kids, but in our discussion we don't pay enough attention to this fact that is an unalterable fact.
At this point, and following Sam's statement, during the sixth grade era for this group, I did some special work with Freddie in trying to see whether I could reach him by devoting extra time to him, just as you're doing in certain areas. I did this in art, because he was interested in art, and yet he felt he couldn't produce. And after a while, I went to his records, and I recall that one point mentioned there was that there was the slight possibility of brain damage.
Well,
and I wonder whether this is something we should discuss at this
point,
like or what has happened
this
since
whole
then.
Point that Sam has raised, because I, on this summary of analysis of this situation, I have a final point as a factor in the development of these children, and that point is a confidence in the possibility of growth. Because I do not subscribe to the idea that they're unalterable factors here, I feel that when we talk about unalterable factors, that it may very well be true, but only God knows what the unalterable minimum is. We don't. And if we set up to know, then immediately we create barriers for the youngsters. Now that doesn't mean a naive and sentimental confidence in the possibility of any child to do anything. Far from it. I think the important thing here is we look at a Freddie and we say, not does this boy have the innate capacity to do this, but rather, what is the level on which the learning must be geared in order to reach this boy? That's important. We cannot work on the assumption that a Freddie is going to be able, say, make the same progress as a John at a particular point. And we don't know, and we can't say whether this is innate or whether it is the environment. But we do, it's extremely important for us to gear what we are doing to the present ability and take a child step by step. How far we'll be able to take them is something that, if we determine in advance, we are shortchanging that child. And I think this is a very basic educational point. And I'm not talking about Sam now, but I know that one of the factors in the life of Phyllis in this group, in this school, was that it was said, well, this girl can do nothing. Send her to a vocational school where she can learn to be a good wife. And question that radiology too, but the implication, she doesn't need any brains to be a good wife, and there's nothing you can do with her, so we'll write her off. And I think that this is an important factor, and I don't think we should have any sentimental or unrealistic attitudes, but I do think that as long as a youngster is with us, that we don't cease to give up,
but that we see what we can do to reach the child where they are and move them a little farther along.
Because I wanted to ask Sam, what, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I wanted to ask you, what difference would it make? Suppose this is true. Suppose one does have an IQ down here and one has an IQ up here, and they both have blocks. But in the classroom, you know, it might, I don't know what their IQ is. But if you either then have to reach the conclusion that they shouldn't be in this classroom, and you segregate them and put them in groups where they're all going at a certain level, or else that in this classroom you have to do, as Norman has pointed out, try to raise their level and see growth and development.
I didn't think that I said anything about not trying to raise their level. I didn't think I said anything about giving up with these kids. All I tried to do, perhaps I didn't express myself properly, I indicated, I remember in my point that that it is dangerous to go along with those, and I certainly can't agree with them, who feel that because a person has a, let's say, limited IQ, that one can't do anything with them. I'm opposed to that kind of philosophy. At the same time, I think it becomes, Norman used the word naive, I think it becomes foolish to take the viewpoint that we can do whatever we want with these kids as regards intellectual development if we employ the proper techniques. That was the point I tried to raise. I don't say, it would be foolish of me to say, and I don't mean to, that we should give up on these kids. We should try as best we can to raise their level, to make them more aware of things, to make them more proficient, but also to recognize it while we're working that possibly if they don't reach a certain level, it isn't only our fault. That's all I'm trying to say. Whereas with the Johnny, it's completely different. I think that there should be some differentiation made, and none is being made. And
What I mean is that
the implication is that I say to give up on these kids. I certainly didn't mean to imply anything.
No, I did say that when I said what I said, I was not talking about your attitude. But I do say that...